Welcome to episode 63 of Kuiperian Commentary. And we've entered this Pentecost season, the summer months, which can be fairly chaotic. And then once in a while, we try to find a bit of harmony, especially when Dustin and I get together. And so, Dustin, it's good to have you back in another episode of Kuiperian, brother.
Hey, man. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I'd like to talk to you again, Dustin. Summer is just a very unique season. The whole liturgy and structure of the year goes out the window with incredible velocity, and it doesn't want to come back for several months. And so it's interesting to just be on social media in an age when, in a time of the year when people have probably an excessive amount of time in their hands. Is that right?
Yeah, that's a fair way to say it. And where there's too much time, bad things can come from it.
That's right. And our discussion is talking about how to do theology in the Twitter age. And our goal is probably to enumerate the good, the bad, and the ugly of doing theology in this vastly bizarre season of church history, I would say, a season where there is too much exposure. There are too many voices, and it becomes kind of a cacophony at times. Too many debates, which can draw our attention to unnecessary things in church life. There was a time when there was one major debate, and we could almost long for the days of the federal vision.
Yeah.
I feel like we live in an age where there are dozens of federal vision controversies ongoing. You know, I can just think of the recent complementarian debates, debates over sexuality, same-sex attraction. Some of these are higher in the hierarchy, the scale of things, but it's very hard to keep up with everything. So I guess one of the first questions I think is worthy of consideration is, does a Christian, let's not say those in positions of authority in the church, but does the regular layman who wants to live their lives to the glory of God, working 9 to 5, caring for their children, living their lives as single people, do they have some kind of responsibility to keep up with everything going on in the church today?
Yeah, it's such a good question. You know, I hope not, because I know I don't keep up with everything. You know, you mentioned how many things there are. And in addition to sort of keeping up with them, it's just being able to evaluate their importance. You know, it's
right.
Hard to know sometimes, because, you know, every little niche theological debate is somebody's wheelhouse and the most important thing to them, that when you stumble into it, it feels really, really important, because everybody is so invested in it, that it is hard to sort of know what level of importance should you give to it. I'll say something positive just about sort of, you know, lay people who are interested in theology.
Let's start with the good before we deal with the bad and the ugly. Go ahead.
Yeah. You know, I don't know when this will air, but my Breakpoint article this week is about, did you watch the Democratic presidential debate? The one with like Mayor Pete and Joe Biden?
I watched sections of both.
Yeah. Mayor Pete said something about how, you know, Republicans sort of will cloak their language in faith talk. And he said, we don't like to do that as Democrats because we strongly believe in separation of church and state.
Right.
And, one of the points I had, you know, I remember writing almost this exact same article in the last presidential debate, because someone always says this, right? Don't bring your faith to this sphere, because that's bringing the church. But the thing about the Bible is, as you know, is it's not restricted to the church. You know, it has things to say to business people. It has things to say in the realm of the family, and all sorts of, in politics, even in justice system. It speaks to all of life, right? Not just the church. So I think one helpful thing about doing theology in the context of social media, Twitter and Facebook, is that it does kind of take the Bible out of the silo of the church, and it scatters its seed wide. And, you know, I think that's a good thing insofar as it's God's word just going widely. And I'll say too, for you, I think whenever I think of people doing theology well in the context of Twitter and Facebook, I think of two people. One of them is George Grant, who you know, a wonderful pastor in sort of the yes. Nashville area, who is just constantly using his Facebook and his Twitter as a way of doing theology, but sort of in an encouraging way. Mm-hmm. He's not real argumentative or anything like that, but just providing a great theological resource. I mean, I go every day. He's one person. And the second person is you. I think you have a really unique ability. Usually post a picture with it, which is good because it catches my eye with a picture. But you offer really sort of wise advice a lot of times, and sometimes just a reflection on Facebook. How do you think through, you know, you have a million different ways to use your time, but you invest time in social media and giving theological reflections on Facebook, on Twitter. How do you sort of think through that?
Well, first of all, thank you for your kind comments. I think that the social media can receive the same criticism that politics receives. It's polarized, and in some ways I find that polarization disturbing. In other ways, I find it endearing. I think there is a time when we need to really stand our ground, and this is who we are. I do think that that we tend to thrive, however, because I think it's human nature to thrive on the polarization department. And because finding, to use another P, because finding peace is a lot harder. It requires several additional steps, and it takes us out of our comfort zone to the point where at times we have to concede to things that we're not ready to concede. And so it really, peace is harder than to be polemic. And so in light of that, and in light of the fact that I have a very unique calling as a pastor, as you do, pastor and theologian, so part of my desire in being engaged in social media is to provide an open door for people to enter into a conversation that before they thought that perhaps they said, look, I didn't know I could have this conversation unless it were in a polemical environment. But now I have this guy who is opening the door to have this conversation in an environment that appears to be open for dialogue and where I don't feel that my thoughts are crushed, or he is touching on a subject that I've always cared about but didn't know I was able to ask about. So that's sort of been my perspective as I've approached doing theological work, and theology in the broad sense, but doing theological work in the social media age.
Yeah, absolutely. And appreciate you talking about your context and doing that, because that kind of allows room for, as a pastor, you're trying to create this pathway for people asking questions and so forth. And someone else who isn't a pastor, who's maybe just a businessman or a mom or whatever, it sort of allows some flexibility for everybody being in a different place, right? And not everybody's tone has to match sort of exactly. We've said some things about positive and then we've said cautions and sort of how to go about doing theology in a Twitter age. What do you think is sort of built in? What are some built in negatives of Twitter that we sort of have to be aware and guard ourselves against?
The most obvious built in negative is that people think that they have to opine almost immediately after an event. So I know that's an obvious point, but I think it's an important one, because I think one of the fruits of the Spirit is patience. And if there's one place that we lack that virtue, is on social media. We don't give time for the Spirit to work in our hearts and help us orchestrate 140 characters more faithfully and consistently and biblically. Yeah. And so when we don't give the time for the Spirit to sort of convict us of our own sins, it's quicker to jump into the conversation with an observation that's obviously an overreaction. So what the lack of patience does is it forces us into an overreactive mode, and very, very little good can come out of that. The vast majority of consequences are negative in that regard. And so we don't think through these conversations carefully. We just feel that we need to throw in our voices quickly. And what that does is it diminishes the sophistication of any conversation and the theological framework. And also, I think, diminishes the power of our witness in a social media age. We have entire theological discussions taking place in a social media platform. And so that elevates the importance of the conversation in our words. And it just seems that the speed of social media age catches us off guard, and it tempts us in an area where I think we're weakest, which is in the area of thinking before we speak.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, another thing I think of is being overly solidified or getting concrete in ideas too young. Whitney, my wife, is very gracious and kind to me after I preach. But one thing she will say occasionally when it's true, and she did just the other day, I preached somewhere, and afterwards I said, "How do you feel like that went?" And she said, "At one point, you went into your preacher voice." Mm. And whenever she says this, what she means is, and I do it whenever I'm tired. Mm-hmm. Whenever I'm tired, it's really hard to be in the moment. And like in that particular time, I had preached on this passage before, and it's kind of a defense mechanism too, but it's sort of just a way of like becoming a caricature of yourself.
Right.
And you can sort of zone out. And maybe that's inevitable to some degree, that as you get older, you know, you're not going to change your mind as much, and you're going to get sort of solidified. But what strikes me is, you know, there'll be like a 24-year-old on Facebook who's just like digging his heels in that, you know, you can't be a Christian and be an Arminian or something like that.
Right.
And it's stuff that, you know, they're just so confident, so young. And I think to myself, it's easy for me. I think about when I was 20 and 22 and 23. I mean, I changed my mind on all sorts of stuff, and it wasn't really embarrassing because no one cared what I thought when I was 23 or 24. Mm-hmm. But now you have these people who've really built a platform, and the cost of changing their mind, of being adaptive, of exploring new possibilities and so forth, they've really sort of sealed in their ideology at a super young age. And it seems to me social media has a way of doing that where, you know, it's not just that you hold this position, but that this position holds you and gives you your identity.
Wow. Yeah.
The thought of shifting on it is, it wouldn't just be, well, I'm changing my idea. It would be, I'm changing my identity. Mm. And it seems to me that, you know, one thing we can do, because I can't, you know, go change that 23-year-old's mind or something, but one thing we can do is try to create an environment where people can change their minds, and it's sort of welcomed, and they're not just beat over the head, you know, or someone expresses a really, you know, firm belief, and perhaps by us engaging and arguing and arguing and arguing, all we're doing is putting them in a corner where they can't change, you know, and just kind of giving people room to say, okay, you know, that's your opinion, and not forcing people to dig in their heels. I don't know exactly how to do that, but it seems to me that solidification and cementing of ideology is a real problem in doing theology in a Twitter age.
Mm. That's a very good point. Now, one thing that I've noticed you do is you avoid the kind of evangelical cliches. I mean, you are obviously, you're reading a lot, which I would say, if you're looking for principles for how to get involved in social media, read a lot, read diversely. But you have a way of bringing in these very juicy words and quotes from authors that sometimes people are not reading online and in book form. How do you go about that process of publishing something on Facebook, for example?
Yeah. You know, it's funny because I basically, whenever I read something and I find it interesting, a quote, there's a journal and sort of a database I'll put it in. But then a lot of times, especially I did this, you know, for the past several years, is I would like put quotes on Facebook just of you know, if I read an article in the Wall Street Journal or just anywhere, you know, I'd do that. And now Facebook has this thing where it pops up like you have a memory of, you know, you said you quoted this 4 years ago or something.
Right.
And you can also search it. So it's really funny. If I have an article due, I'll search on my Facebook wall, like charity or something. And I'll have like 50 quotes on charity. And so that's actually kind of amazing. It's not so much now that I'm using my other work to put into Facebook, but now Facebook, I'm able to sort of reap that in a little bit. Mm-hmm. But just in terms of reading, you know, some good advice I got early on was there's a set of like great books of classic literature and culture and so forth that you need to immerse yourself in. And I went to a college, thankfully, that had a great books program and so forth. But what they said was, you really have to just follow your nose whenever it comes to reading. And a lot of times, you know, if you bind yourself to, I'm only going to read Moby Dick, I'm only going to read Augustine and Calvin, you sort of let that, you know, the perfect be the enemy of the best. And so this summer, I've read a ton of autobiographies on different comedians. I read, anyways, so, you know, you kind of just, whatever you find interesting in that moment, you read it. And then, like you're saying, the truth is, whether it's preaching or writing or whatever, that sort of information is, and those quotes and those insights and so forth are going to be different enough that, that it does create a little bit of texture to what you're saying. Yes. You know, of course you can just say like, here's this theological position or whatever, but if you are able to say, you know, and here's how this could be filtered through Mozart or something, it gives people some hooks that they can start hanging your otherwise sort of disembodied principles on, right?
Absolutely. And I think that's when you think of theological discourse in the age of Twitter, what I think about are the kinds of one-liners and the kinds of dismissive observations that people make. So it is very rare to find someone, with few exceptions, that are on social media for the purpose of engaging and learning. Most people are there because they have a particular agenda, and they want to make that agenda known, and they want the world to sort of imbibe of their agenda overnight. You know, even though it may have taken them 20 years to get that position, they want the whole world to come to it the next day. So we're seeing a lot of that. And when you have somebody who offers sort of a nuanced, a substantive, a textured view on something, it makes theology something attractive. It makes theology something worthy to pursue. I am very grateful that as you mentioned earlier, that the transitions I went through were not made live on social media in my, you know, late teens and early 20s, because I'm sure I would have been embarrassed of those moments. In fact, when I came to, let's say my position, came to Presbyterian convictions, I had the luxury of going back to all my college friends whom I offended deeply, and I asked their forgiveness. I just don't think that happens anymore. I think people are very proud of being assertive and harsh. And what that does, it doesn't engage other people into your thought process. So one of the premises I have, it's a principle I have on Facebook, and because I think that's where the majority of my traffic lies. But one of the principles I have is I will only respond twice to people. And so if somebody poses a very genuine question, I'll be glad to break that rule. But if somebody is desiring a fight, I will give them the luxury of responding once or maybe twice. And if they break that pattern, that is, if they are pursuing war, I'll very easily unfollow or I will block them. And I know that seems radical, but I think it's the way of, I want to preserve the little sphere of influence I have for healthy and productive conversation. And as we say in church life, it takes one family to destroy the peace of a church. It takes one person to sort of destroy the environment that you have created, you know, because I think it's an environment that can be very beneficial. And if somebody comes in and attempts to change the dynamic of that environment, it can turn people off, and it can also do damage to your witness on social media.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I just saw, what's his name? I think Alexander Young, maybe, who was the moderator, not this previous General Assembly, maybe even 3 years ago. Anyways, he was moderator of the PCA General Assembly probably 3 years ago. And he just posted on Facebook. He said, here's what everybody needs to understand. He says, I'm a professor in, I think he teaches sociology or education, not theology. He said, I'm a professor at a university with a lot of non-believers. I'm, you know, a Presbyterian churchman. So I'm around church people. He says, I'm around, and he names like four or five different groups who he knows. And he says, whenever you're coming whenever I post something and you're being argumentative from either direction, whether you're, you know, quite progressive or quite conservative or whatever, he said, what you need to know is you're not just engaging with me, you're engaging with this world. And he basically asked for a little bit of sort of, you know, this is probably a cheesy way to say it, but, and these are my words, it's kind of a missional space, where a space of grace where you can, you know, you sort of recognize, I don't know this person, right, who I'm arguing with on another person's status. I don't know this person. But the person who is our connection this is his friend, and sort of allowing, you know, maybe I'm not the best person to be making this argument with this person. And in fact, as you say, maybe I'm hurting this guy's witness. Maybe I'm actually, you know, pushing this person further from the kingdom because I'm assuming this sort of role as teacher or lecturer. Anyways, it made me think about, you know, that's so true. There are all these just myriad worlds whenever there's an argument on someone's status. And, you know, for all you know, this is that person's, you know, grandmother,
right,
that you're arguing with. And I do think that's a helpful thing to keep in mind, the context, because if you don't do that, everybody just becomes, you know, a brain on a stick, right, totally disembodied, totally contextualized sociologically or familially or whatever. So that's a helpful, I think that's a helpful.
So Dustin, what is the, I don't know if we give some examples here, but what's the ugly of social media? When do we see that and we say, wow, this has a potential of destroying so much? What are some examples perhaps of ugly ways in which Christians have engaged in social media and just done damage to the cause of Christ?
Yeah, gosh. Well, I think one thing is whenever someone's confidence is so disproportionately large as compared to their knowledge. Because I think what that can do is, you know, there are lots of great reasons, I think, to believe, you know, not only that there is a God, but that he revealed himself supremely in Jesus. But when, and someone may hold that conviction quite, you know, quite dearly, but then they get into a Facebook argument and their knowledge, you know, they believe this firmly, but their knowledge of the thing they're arguing is really limited. And what it allows people to do, you know, earlier I said there's one danger of you yourself becoming a caricature of what you used to be because you're just so ossified and you're unchanging. Another danger would be that you cause the person who you're interacting with to create a caricature in their head that you sort of embody. In other words, you know, arguing with someone who's a non-believer and atheist about intelligent design type things. When you're doing that and you're very, very confident, not just that there is a God, but you're very, very confident in these sort of evidences that you're giving, and the person you're talking to is a scientist or whatever, and they sort of get the feeling that, you know, this person's very, very confident talking about all these proofs and all these evidences, but it's clear that once you peel back the surface one layer, there's nothing else there for them. I mean, they're just saying these bumper sticker things that they've heard, but they don't actually have that knowledge base. It makes it just so much more difficult to reach that person later because they think, yeah, I've engaged with people like you before. So I think that's something, you know, I think, and as you say, Facebook and Twitter does not reward humility or any sort of middle of the roadness, or it, and it doesn't reward, you know, the I don't know. And I'll just say, to give myself as an example, you and I are part of a closed Facebook group with maybe 15 other people. And the other day y'all were saying, someone in there said, oh, this person died. And the person was like a political philosopher or something like that. Anyways, I'd never heard of this person, but I Googled him. I saw that I just read the person, like the first line of his Wikipedia page. Then later I was talking to some other people and they bring up this guy's death. And they say, what do you think about this guy? And just from that like first Wikipedia page, I kind of gathered this is who he was and this is where he's coming from or something. And I almost offered an opinion as if for the past, you know, decade, I've really been wrestling with this guy's political thought. When in reality, I need to say, I know nothing about the guy. I read two sentences on a Wikipedia page, right? But social media has a way of just giving you, you know, all the confidence in the world that's totally unearned and totally undeserved. And that ultimately, you know, people sort of see through, I think. Let me ask you, that's a negative way I've seen it. Has there been any really great examples where you think Facebook or Twitter has been just extremely helpful?
Yes. And I have, there's some very unique ways in which it's been helpful. I think it has been, it has served the local church in a very, very valid way. It has drawn a lot of people to consider, you know, it's, we live in a day when only the church that, the church that shines brightest are the churches that shine on Sunday morning, and literally with the lights and all the, you know, stereotypical ways we speak of these churches that are a lot more concerned about entertainment than substance. But social media has allowed small churches like mine and perhaps small churches like yours to actually lay our case out to the public and give a more perhaps a nuanced view of what church life ought to look like. And perhaps what is important to contemplate when you think of a church. And I think that's an important avenue for us to take advantage of in our day. And I think we've tried to do that with our church in Pensacola. And I'm sure you guys have done that very well as well. But people are I think this is a comment that Jordan Peterson makes quite a bit, is that people are more substantive than we give them credit for. And they don't know that they are substantive until we present them with something that is substantive. Then they say, wait a minute, I've always longed for that thing of substance, but I didn't know how to put into words, neither did I know it existed. And here it is. And so they want to grab a hold of that. I think social media has helped us sharpen our arguments a lot more. And so that's been a very beneficial way that I think the church has gained from that. Another department, of course, I think is the one we, you know, just before this conversation here, I was updating my congregation on an upcoming funeral of the father of a kind and gracious man in our congregation. And it has united people in healthy causes too. And I think a healthy cause would be the cause of grieving with those who grieve, weeping with those who weep. And so in this sense, I think the charitable intentions of the church has increased. Our ability to be more self-aware of other people's grief has increased. And there are abuses in all these departments, of course, but overall, I think that's been an incredible light in the church.
Yeah, absolutely. And to your previous point about it allows maybe smaller churches to have a bigger platform, it also, and this has been something I've sort of just always intuitively believed, that some of the greatest theologians or perhaps the greatest living theologians aren't living in the walls of a seminary. They're not in an ivory tower or something. They're pastors who just week in and week out have preached through the whole Bible and have an amazing, you know, it's like someone who who's just walked the same land over and over again, and their mind has just become a map of that land. And social media has, you know, I can think of specific people who otherwise would not have had, you know, the status to publish a book or something, but really do have an amazing platform and have incredible insights. And no doubt their voice wouldn't have been heard because of the place in which God has them shepherding his flock, were it not for social media.
Yes, there are bad things. There are even ugly things happening in social media. But I think the overall effect, if we were to quantify it, is that the gospel is being proclaimed in ways it has never been proclaimed before. I was encouraged to abandon social media altogether because it's a platform owned by liberals and that kind of argument, which I'm sure you've heard. And my argument was essentially, yeah, but as long as whoever is ruling this social media platform allows me to contradict their worldview day after day after day and provide a distinctly Christian platform day after day after day, I am going to take every opportunity I can, because that's where the masses are and that's where change can happen. And so I think that there's we need to be very careful that we don't overreact to the gifts that God has given us. And I think social media can be a great gift. There are going to be abuses and overreact, but as I've always quoted, I think it came from Luther, but the abuse of something is not an argument against its proper use. So you need to be self-consciously aware that you have a unique role on social media. And if you're intentional about what you publish, and if you're occasionally or perhaps better, frequently aware of the places where you do overreact, if you're having that conversation on a regular basis, I think platforms like Facebook and Twitter can be incredibly fruitful platforms for any Christian. A really fascinating conversation, and I hope those who are listening will take heed to things we said and perhaps contribute in a comment section. We're all engaged. It's very rare to find somebody who's completely disengaged, and even if they're disengaged from social media, they're going to be around people who are always letting them know that they ought to be engaged or sharing something they've learned or that they've come across. And so this is the world we live in. And so our response is not to forsake it, but to be in it in a faithful and effective way. And I think we need to take what God has given us, the world we're living in, and use it in a way that honors God. And so thank you for your contributions, Dustin. And as always, a delight to speak with you.
Wonderful talking to you also. Have a great summer, Yuri.